are going to take a look at animal emotions on the show today. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Wonder if animal emotions are similar to our emotions? How can you tell what your pet is feeling? Well, we're going to talk about that today with Patricia McConnell. Really great to have her back. She's a certified applied animal behaviorist, international speaker and author. She and I co-hosted Calling All Pets for 14 years. Oh, my goodness. And one of her most popular books, and certainly a favorite of mine, is For the Love of a Dog, Understanding Emotion in You and Your Best Friend. And with some great photographs in the center of that book that really kind of drive it all home. You may have some questions about animal emotions. Would you like some help with your pet's behavior? Love to hear from you. I hope you'll give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Patricia McConnell, welcome back.
Oh, it's fun to be here always.
You know, there was a time when researchers, I think, were chastised a bit for saying animals have emotions. That's been changing a lot, I think, over the last few years. And what brought that change on, do you think?
You know, it's actually... I would say it's two things. One is science. Is the science is starting to catch up with the complexity of the animal mind. And it's really complicated, right? But it was easy to say, like, oh, animals don't experience fear. Or even you know, talking about newborn children, right?
Yeah.
Right? Remember it was argued that they didn't feel pain?
Yeah.
Right?
No. Oh, my goodness.
And so one of the things that's happened is that the science is literally catching up, is that we are now able to look and quantify and understand better what's going on internally. You know, Skinner, B.F. Skinner, the famous psychologist, talked about the black box.
Skinner box.
This is a different box.
Oh, a different box. The black box.
The black box was the box inside your... that you couldn't get into.
He argued
that you could never understand what was going on in the mind, the perceptions of another person. You never, never could. And actually what he really said was we can't do science on that because we can't quantify it. We can't actually do research on that. It's too subjective. Well, now we can, because of all these new technologies, from MRIs to just a whole elaborate array of possibilities, you know, better physiological tests, etc. We understand much better now what's similar about emotions in non-human mammals and people. So I think that's one. I think science has come to the rescue, and we're going to talk about science a little bit, and a great opportunity for people to learn more about the science of animal behavior for free in Milwaukee in early August. But I think the other drive, Larry, is the fact that our relationships with animals are changing, at least in the Western world. And well, I think all over the world, but rather than this sort of Descartesian argument that emotions have nothing to do with cognition and intelligence, our relationship now has become more companionable, you know, less dominionistic, basically.
Yeah.
And so I think it's being driven from sort of the top and the bottom, both. I don't know if science is the top, but you know what I mean. From two different directions. And it's leading to some really important advances in welfare for the animals that we love and want to understand.
Well, and you know, there's just the average person sitting here. I can look at Coco and Tiger, and I feel like I know when they're mad or when they're happy or... I mean, I think the average person sees emotions, and just most people just wouldn't believe that you couldn't tell.
Yeah. You know, the argument that animals don't have emotions flies in the face of the experience of many of us,
yes.
Right? It's like you're going to tell me a dog can't experience happiness and a cat can't get angry, you know, and vice versa. Both goes both ways, right? However, one thing I'd love to talk about is how it's easy to misinterpret expressions and behaviors and postures and make incorrect assumptions and attributions about emotions.
You know, I want to go back to For the Love of a Dog for a minute because you wrote that about 10 years ago. I've got one of the new paperback copies right in front of me. And didn't you get a little pushback on that when you wrote it?
I was amazed, Larry. So here I am. Here's an example. I'm in Boulder, Colorado, right? And I'm giving a talk on For the Love of a Dog, which is basically compares different emotions in people and dogs, and what's same, what's different, right?
Yeah.
And after my talk, somebody raised their hand and said, "I'm a professor at the University of Colorado here at Boulder, and I had dinner with colleagues of mine. One's a physicist, one's a chemist, one's, I don't remember all the fields, but these were PhDs, highly educated people, and they got into a big argument over at dinner over whether animals could experience emotions or not. And this is 10 years ago. I got an email from somebody who was furious with me and not using my abbreviation that I'm going to use now, said, "What you're saying is just BS. That's just ridiculous." And then went on to say that I was just making this up and I was anthropomorphizing and I didn't know what I was talking about. So it is actually still controversial in some places whether animals can experience emotions or not. And I think that is partly because the more we understand about the richness and the depth of the emotional life of other mammals, the more our relationship with them gets a little bit more complicated.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about reading the reactions, and do they react in similar ways as humans in terms of the emotions that they feel? There are differences, aren't there?
There are differences, and there's similarities, you know?
Yeah.
Glass half empty, glass half full. So fear, for example, when I was writing that book, I expected to see a lot of similarities between facial expressions in dogs and people. I was stunned at how similar it was, at how very specific muscles in the face change. You know, even Darwin did this great study. He actually put little electrodes on the face of colleagues of his, and then they put electric current through and see what muscles moved where to try and figure out what muscle movements went along with sadness and happiness. And so I expected some similarities, but I didn't. I was shocked at how very similar it is. So fear, for example, very primitive emotion, believed by almost all up-to-date researchers that absolutely mammals, and by the way, when we say animals, I'm talking mammals. I have nothing to say about the emotional life of a cockroach, although actually I do, but we can get back into that if we want to talk about it. But fear is a very primitive emotion, and it's very important for the survival of an animal who has a lot of behavioral flexibility, right?
Yeah.
You can't function without fear. You get killed if you're not fearful. And all the internal physiology and brain function of fear is very similar in cats and horses and dogs as it is in people. But And the expressions are very similar. However, here's a kicker. What about guilt? What about the emotion of guilt, which most researchers, psychologists, neurobiologists argue, and I think credibly, is a very complex emotion. You know, fear is a very simple emotion, right? It has all kinds of nuances to it and can get complicated sort of within it. But in general, biologically, fear is a very simple emotion. And it's pretty primitive. You got to have it. Guilt, you know, it's a little bit more complicated. Guilt means you understand that there's a set of social rules and you've broken them and you feel really badly about it. And very ironically to me, Larry, the emotion that animal behaviorists and progressive dog trainers and veterinarians see most commonly in dogs is fear. but it's the least, it's the one that people least use to explain their dog's behavior. People are very resistant to saying their dog is doing what it's he or she is doing because they're afraid. Very resistant to it. But they're very quick to say, oh, my dog is guilty. He knows he shouldn't pee on the carpet. He knows he shouldn't have chewed up the pillow because look at his face. Look how guilty he looks. When actually there's a lot of research that makes it clear that's appeasement. That's like, don't get mad at me. And we all know that face. We make it, right?
Yeah.
You know, little subtle, I mean, we all make it all the time. Like, I do it all the time. I go to a restaurant. It's like, oh, the waitress is really busy, right? And I say like, oh, could I have the sweet potato fries instead of the regular fries? And I'm like changing my posture and I'm changing my facial expression to keep her, you know, to hope that she will sort of be aligned with me and not get upset with me. And that's what that, quote, guilty look is in dogs. And there's great research on this that makes it really, really clear. It's really simple. They put a treat down on the floor. They told the owner to tell the dog to leave it. The dogs all knew that cue. Owner left the room. Researcher picks up the treat, right? Not the dog. And then lies to the owner who comes back in and says, your dog took it. Your dog ate the food. And the owner goes, oh, what did you do? And the dog gets this incredibly, quote, guilty look on its face. But it has nothing to be guilty about, right? It's appeasement. So we're slow to make attributions of fear to explain aggression, disobedience, but we're very quick to ascribe guilt to dogs when I think that's the one we have in common the least.
Talking today with Dr. Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist. And the topic today has to do with animal behavior emotions. So join in with your questions and comments. The number 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patricia McConnell, as we talk about animal behavior and especially zeroing in a bit on emotions today. And we'll take some calls now. Greg and Racine, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks. Yesterday we had our six-month-old golden retriever puppy, Spade. And in the instructions from the vet, we were told to watch for all kinds of things, including physical things involving the incision, of course, and things like lethargy. But also on this list was that we should watch for signs of depression. And I wish, while I had been at the vet, I would have noticed that, would have asked what that means for a dog. And in particular, what we should be watching for that's different from lethargy. Or are they, in this case, probably kind of one and the same thing? But maybe there's a difference between physical lethargy and more emotional depression. But depression was the word they used, and I'd love to hear Dr. McConnell's thoughts on what we should be looking for in our puppy in the next day or two.
That's an interesting question for you, Patricia.
Patricia's smiling over here. Larry's reading my emotional expressions, because what I want you to do, but jokingly, I would love it if you contacted your vet clinic and say, exactly, you know, ask them that question, you know, exactly what were you talking about here? Because I think people use, and sometimes even veterinarians, use that term very loosely.
Yeah.
So first of all, you know, I had one of my dogs, Spade, Maggie, not as a puppy, but as an older dog for a variety of health reasons. And she was, you could argue if she was depressed, because the signs of depression in humans anyway is indeed lethargy, you know?
Yeah.
is sort of lack of motivation. You know, that's the primary symptom of emotional depression, is not wanting to do anything. I have to say, spaying is a huge surgery. It's a massive intrusion into an animal's body. And so if a dog is quiet and lethargic after it's spayed, I would say it's not emotionally depressed. It hurts. It's in pain, and it doesn't feel good. You know, a lot of times the anesthetic makes you feel awful, and that's true with dogs as well as it is people. So I would never myself categorize a dog after surgery as being depressed unless after the physical healing has done, you see some behavioral signs of a dog who basically has its head down on the floor all the time, just sort of doesn't want to get up. Now, I have seen that with dogs who lost a family member, whether it was another dog or a person in the household. You see dogs who appear to be grieving. They don't want to get up. Nothing makes them happy. They're not excited about anything. They just lie on the floor with their chin on the ground, very much like a person who doesn't want to get out of bed. So I'm not saying that depression is not possible in dogs, but I just think after spaying, it's just not even a term I would use. I would say watch for signs your dog after a few days of healing, 3 to 4 days, is not getting her energy back.
Okay.
And there, you know, one of the this talk. Can I talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
Series of talks a little bit, just because it's making me think about it. I mentioned earlier, there's a incredible opportunity for people who are interested in these kind of topics, and it's free. The Animal Behavior Society, which I'm a member of, is one of those. It's a meeting of scientists who study animal behavior, and it normally costs hundreds and hundreds of dollars to go. But we've created a half day for the public that is going to summarize a tremendous amount of the recent really cool research on behavior. And it's all done by great, great people who have all taken this work and applied it. So Dan Estep, Emma Grieg, Robin Foster, who works with horses, by the way.
Yeah.
So all of us are going to work together to present an afternoon, again, free to the public, August 4th, UW-Milwaukee campus. You can go to either my website or you can go to the Animal Behavior Society website and look for Public Day at their conference in Milwaukee. It's August 4th. And you're going to learn all kinds of amazing information about the new research, but specifically everybody who's speaking is applied. Every one of us applies that work into real life. So it's a really fun opportunity.
And it's an afternoon or what's the time?
Yeah, it's an afternoon. I think it's 2 to 6.
2 to 6.
August 4th, UW-Milwaukee campus. Go to my website or go to the Animal Behavior website, go to their conference, and then look for free public day or public day.
And your website is?
PatriciaMcConnell.com. It's very non-intuitive. Never figure out how to get there.
Greg, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Don in Highland will turn to you next. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you, Larry. Thank you, Pat. I have a 6 or 7 year old green cheek conure who also lives with a cockatiel. They get along very well. They always have. But in the last few years, the green cheek has been pulling all her feathers out.
Oh, dear.
We've had her checked for mites.
Okay.
Haven't found anything there. Somebody talked about aloe vera spray, and you can put it on their skin, and maybe they have psoriasis or something like that, or itch. No way to stop it, and she's done the whole chest.
Aww.
Under the arms. Very good bird, will walk around on your shoulder all day long and take food and play with jewelry and loves to sit and look out the window. These birds have an open cage in one room of the house, so they're not and more toys than most grandchildren.
So they have a really good life, right?
Yeah,
sounds like. Yeah.
Well, I don't feel like a parrot. I am not a parrot expert, but so I'll tell you what I know. Mm-hmm. And then we can go from there. The two main reasons I know that motivate or create this feather pulling are something internal, some physiological issue, or some behavioral issue related to stress, which actually is also internal, right? Because
sure.
That's changing physiology too. It sounds like parrots have a really nice life. And those conures are beautiful, by the way. Is your conure also noisy? I live with a conure.
They'll let you know when they're
Holy
not
moly, they're very, very loud. Wow. But I know there's a very famous parrot, Alex, who was not a conure, but it was owned by Irene Pepperberg.
Yeah.
Alex, the famous parrot who learned to use English words and showed us that they could understand very abstract cognitive concepts. But he was a horrible feather puller. And he did for years, and it was hard for Irene because all these, you know, all these companies would come in and take videos of him, and he looked horrible a part of the time. She finally discovered that with him it was diet, and he wasn't getting enough oil. And when she changed his diet, he stopped feather pulling.
Oh.
So that's one thing I would look into. The resource I would suggest is going to real experts on parrots and feather pulling. There's an organization in Madison called the, I think it's the Madison Area Caged Bird Society. It's something like that. It's very close.
Yeah.
But if you Google Madison Area Caged Bird, they have some real experts there. And I would use that resource because, you know, you're absolutely right to be concerned. Something's wrong. If she was happy and healthy, she wouldn't be doing it. So the trick is to be a detective. Try thing A, then try thing B, and see if you can get it solved. So good for you for trying. And I love conures, but I have to admit, it was a hard year for me because I'm like a border collie. I'm really sound sensitive.
There you go, Don. Thank you for calling. Lynn in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Patricia, I have a rescue dog for the last 2 months, and she's about a 10-pound poodle mix. Anyway, she was going outside in the backyard, potting in the backyard, no problem. My husband and I recently went on a 5-day vacation, and my daughter house sat with her, my grandchildren, and their 12-year-old golden doodle, and the two dogs got along great. When we come back, she doesn't want to go, she doesn't want anything to do with our backyard lawn. You know, she will go by the house where there's weeds, and I'm trying treats to get her on the lawn, and it's sometimes I'm pulling, you know, to get her, you know, to get back on the lawn. But any suggestions here?
Wow. So let me see if I get this straight. So you were gone for a while.
For 5 days, yes.
Right? And was she there, or was she with you?
She was at the house, and my daughter was here with the two grandchildren. They're 11 and 9, and then their 12-year-old golden doodle. And they were getting along fine, according to my daughter.
And there was no incident that your daughter could think of?
Yes, we went round and round over this. I don't know.
Okay. Well, something happened, right? And dogs are very location-specific. People actually are, too, although often unconsciously. So something traumatic could have happened in the backyard, and now your dog is afraid to go out there, even though it had nothing to do with the yard itself, right? It just happened there. But again, you know, that's the way the brain often works and emotions often work is like a car accident, sort of famous that people remember, all kinds of weird details that have nothing to do with anything. A famous example by an ethologist, somebody of my field, is actually hit by a car quite badly. And he saw the car coming at him. And he could remember this. He identified the species of the bugs caught in the grill of the car. So the mind is a very strange thing, especially when it's trying to record the details around fear, and it often records the wrong ones. It doesn't know what's relevant, what isn't relevant. So it's possible that something happened that scared your dog, and your dog is thinking it has to do with the smell of the grass or something. But that's all just theoretical, right? Your question is, shut up, Tricia, what do I do now, right? So I would do a couple things. One, if you know other dogs, if you have friends who have dogs who are friends of your dog, I would bring them back because dogs are great social facilitators. And often you'll have one dog who's afraid of a location, getting in the car, for example, or even meeting people they don't know. And if they see another dog having a good time out there, they're more likely to go do it too than if you smooch and coax and try and force. So that's the first thing I would try. So if that's not possible, is she still on the line? Right? You're there?
I'm here.
So,
I'm here.
Yes. So, Lynn, so here's one question. Is there more than one way? Editing my grammar here. Is there more than one way to get into the backyard?
Yes and no. It is possible. I could take her from the front all the way to the back, and then there's another gate. I could go that way, yes.
The reason I suggest that is sometimes there's this conditioned association between, like, entering a place, you know, going from place A into place B, that mm-hmm. is scary. But if you go into place B from place C, the animal's mm-hmm. okay. I actually just did that. We were in northern Wisconsin. I gave a talk at the Mercer Library, which was so fun. Thank everybody out there mm-hmm. who came. It was really fun. We're staying on a little cabin, and little Tootsie, our little cavalier, we were taking a long walk down this beautiful road. And Tootsie is old. She's like 14. We don't know exactly how old. And she just did one of those, like, yeah, I'm not going any farther. I'm just stopping.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm just going to stop here. And I used a trick that I learned when working with horses, which is don't keep trying to go directly forward, but turn her around in a circle right where she stood. So I just turned her around, and we just walked in a circle. And sure enough, we walked right down the road in the original direction I wanted to go. So this is sort of the same idea. You're coming in it from a different way. So that's the other idea I would try. And obviously lots of great food, pieces of chicken. But if you could get another dog in there, I think that's your best bet.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Ken in Blanchardville next. Hi, Ken. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi, and thank you for the show. So you will never convince me that animals don't feel emotion, sadness, excitement, things like that. Because, and I know both of you already agree with this. But our dog, Maggie, who is a Labrador Shepherd mix but looked like a black lab, you know, you'd say you want to go to the car, her ears would twitch, her eyes would open wider, and she's thrilled to go. But my story is this. We took our daughter's cat for what we thought was going to be a temporary amount of time and ended up having the cat for almost 5 years.
Oh, my.
So for the first year and a half, we were so afraid that Maggie was just going to kill the cat.
Uh-oh.
You know, and my joke was, well, she just wants to play with the cat in her mouth. But so we kept them separated for a year and a half. And thinking that the cat's going to go. Well, we just said, that's got to end. We need to integrate these animals somehow. So we did. They became best of buddies. There's, by my screensaver on my computer, is the two of them sleeping together on the mat in front of the door.
Aww.
In the sun.
Aww.
And they were best buddies. Well, the cat finally went back with her daughter. And Maggie moped for like 4 months.
Oh.
She was so depressed that her buddy was gone. I mean, I get emotional just thinking about it, but it was really so present and so clear that she was like, where's my buddy? Where is she?
And I absolutely concur with you that is the context in which I think sadness, a specific mm-hmm. kind of sadness related to a loss of an important social companion, is very similar in people and other highly social mammals. Now, I don't think pandas probably feel that because they're basically solitary. They're asocial. They pretty much want nothing to do with each other. It's sort of a miracle that they ever actually even mate and have babies. Mm-hmm. Which they have a pretty hard time doing, actually. But super social animals, like dogs especially, and horses, and some cats. You know, cats don't read the chapter on how they're supposed to behave in terms of social attachment. Some are sort of independent and aloof. Others are super social and incredibly bonded to their human or another dog or another cat. And so I think there's... there's just no credible argument against saying that the glass is very, very full, you know, comparing depression and grieving basically over the loss of an important social partner in dogs and people. And so, You know, somebody's not too long from now is going to do an MRI study or some kind of an other high tech study in which they're going to compare brain function between people and dogs or whoever in the same context and go like, well, the exact same parts of the brain are active, and so maybe they're different, but surely they're more same than they are different.
I was thinking of the flip side of that, and you had a story about when one of your dogs passed away, you thought the other dog would grieve, and it was just the opposite,
yeah,
wasn't it?
That is a great point. That is a great point, Larry. Yeah. One of my dogs passed away, one of my border collies, and Misty, little Misty Cuffs, little tiny little fox face border collie, who was incredibly sweet to people, afraid of sheep, and not always very nice to other dogs. But she got along fine with Lassie. Lassie was this sweet vanilla ice cream border collie, one of the sweetest dogs you've ever met. And they got along, quote, fine, in that they never fought. Every once in a while, I saw Misty giving a hard eye, sort of a nasty look to Lassie. But it was very rare. And I could say, Miss. So I let Misty, after she died of cancer at age 12, pretty young, and I let her lie in state, and other dogs' reactions were so different and so interesting. And Lassie, first of all, was terrified of going anywhere near her body. Other dogs went up and sniffed it and looked very, very interested. Lassie wouldn't get near it for years. She was like, it's a trick. And then finally she sniffed it, and then after that she literally became like, "Wee!"
I'm happy.
The person I didn't get along with in the house is gone now. Yeah, so you are absolutely right. I think they're similar to us in that they have very different reactions to different individuals.
Let's take a call from Phyllis in Windsor next. Hi, Phyllis. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry and Patricia. So just this morning, I agreed to foster a dog whose owner is in hospice care right now.
Oh, sweet. And, good for you.
And while some other folks are looking for a permanent home, okay, I'll be taking him on Thursday. And I'm just wondering how to smooth this as much as I can for him. And I'm also wondering if I just carry out my normal schedule where I would be gone for, you know, this or that for a few hours. I'm kind of worried about that. I'm wondering whether I should change my schedule and be with him all the time, or just how to handle this. And I've had dogs before.
Gotcha. So you have a lot of dog experience, and that's partly why you're asking this, because it's a very, very astute and important question to ask. Because, you know, I think it's easy to forget that when we change a dog's life, we've thought about it. We know what's happening. The dog knows nothing. You know, it gets ripped out of one place and plunked down in another place. Has no idea why. No idea if it's going to stay. It just has no idea about anything. And so dogs, you know, people talk about dogs are sort of generally happier because they're always living in the moment. Well, it's not always good to live in the moment and nothing but, right?
Yeah.
That's not always a positive thing. So good for you. So a couple of things. And one, with apologies for sounding self-promoting, I just have to say there's a book that Karen London and I wrote that deals with not this issue specifically in fostering a dog for somebody before it goes to a new permanent home, but bringing an adult dog into your home and helping smooth that transition. It's called Love Has No Age Limit. And some of the things it discusses in there is, one, I think you're very wise to think about changing your schedule a little bit if you can. You hate to leave a dog alone the first day or, you know, the next 2 or 3 days before you have any idea of how the dog is settling in. So our standard advice is, first of all, don't assume the dog is house trained in your house. Just because we've generalized houses as this general concept, it doesn't mean dogs have. So the first thing I advise everybody to do is walk around outside where you want the dog to potty, and do not take the dog inside until he or she is pottied. Give them a treat instantly. Don't make a big, loud, crazy fuss over it. I think that can intimidate. Just quietly, that's a good dog, and then give it a treat, a really good treat. Go in the house, and then I would not let it loose in the house because you just sort of don't know how it's good. Is it going to chew? Is it going to pee, right? I would stay relatively quiet. Don't make a big fuss over it, but be there for it. Phyllis, are there other dogs in the house?
No, I lost my last dog in March.
Okay, I'm very sorry you lost your last dog. However, it makes this simpler. And so, you know, in some ways, it makes it a little simpler and a little easier. So I think it's really good to sort of hang out with the dog. Don't give them access to all the house. Go outside a lot. Be relatively sort of quiet, because dogs need some processing time. They need to get their paws on the ground. They need to be like, where am I? And even if you need to have the dog on leash while you're sitting on the couch and reading or something, I like to sit on the floor right beside them. Maybe you're rubbing their belly. Maybe you're rubbing their head, stroking their chin. But just a very quiet, not a lot of visitors. Give them 2 to 3 days and sort of gradually start moving around, you know, and then eventually leave the house for 5 minutes, leave the house for 10 minutes, leave the house for 30 minutes and sort of see how that goes.
But in her case, she's going to be just once a week thing, and the dog will be in other places, I expect.
Okay. What? Explain more. I understand the dog's going to go to a permanent home later.
Is that, maybe right. I misunderstood. Sorry, Phyllis.
Right. We don't have one yet, but there are friends of the current owner who are looking for a permanent place.
So the dog's going to be with you full time, I think,
yeah,
if I got it right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay. I misunderstood.
Pay
Sorry.
No attention to Larry.
Yeah, don't listen to me.
he'll say that back to me and be absolutely accurate very, very soon, I guarantee you. So I hope that's helpful. And again, that book, For the Love of a Dog, goes through things in more detail. But
yeah.
Good for you and good luck. Yeah.
You know, kind of a here's another emotion thing for you. Marie emailed to say she and her husband divorced and she can't have pets in her new place. So she only gets to see her dog once or twice a week.
Mm.
When she drops the dog off, the dog seems sad and doesn't want to go with the ex. This is still going on after a year. Is the dog sad, depressed, or just conditioned to do this at this point? The ex says the dog is fine after Marie leaves.
Well, that would fit with the experience of a lot of parents, right?
Yeah.
It's the transitions where individuals have trouble, right? You know, parents go out to a movie and the kids are screaming and crying. And then the sitter says, as soon as you drove out the driveway, it was fine. Right. So transitions can be very hard. I do share your wish that when your dog saw your ex, there was a lot of, hi, how are you? So good to see you. I would love to see that, too.
Yeah.
So it well might be that the dog prefers to be with you. I don't know if that's something you could, you know, ever work on. You might want to ask yourself the reverse. So when you pick up the dog? Yeah. So when the dog is leaving him and coming to you, what happens?
What happens then is she's this is on,
oh, yes, on,
it was an email, but what I'm guessing is if she comes to pick the dog up once or twice a week, they go to the dog park or they go and do fun things, I'm guessing.
Spoken like a man with experience of families that get disrupted on occasion. You know, it could be sort of the weekend effect of like, oh, we're going to go do really fun things. It could be, but it could also be
the other.
You know, I mean, dogs are just like us. Talk about emotional lives. They have best friends, and they have individuals that they don't like. And for example, my border collie, Maggie, I don't know why, but she absolutely adores me. She just absolutely adores me. And when I come home, you know, I could do videos like the ones of veterans returning home from Afghanistan. I mean, she just, her joy is just, it's wonderful and heartbreaking. I mean, she's just beside herself. She's just over the moon happy to see me. Willie, the Border Collie Willie, who I wrote The Education of Will partly about, who I absolutely adore, who I know adores me, adores Jim a little more. There's no question about it, and I don't have any problem with that. So, yes, so it, you know, it could be the you know, pick up your kid and go have fun effect. And it could be about personality and just social attachment. So, you know, what you do about that is, you know, between you and your attorney and, you know.
And where you live.
And where you live. And,
there we go.
Good luck anyway.
Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist. We're visiting with her about animal behavior, zeroed in a bit on emotions and taking other questions as well. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at all types of behavior among cats and dogs, looked a bit and zeroed in some on emotions in our animals as well with our guest, Patricia McConnell. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll go back to the phones, take some more calls. Cindy in Lake Mills has something for us. Cindy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a one-year-old and a three-year-old, but I'm having problems with my one-year-old Blue Heeler. He just barks and barks and barks, and I'm not real big on collars to make them not, but at bedtime, he just, you know, the three-year-old is roams the house. He has been kennel trained since he was little, and at bedtime, he goes in his kennel, but he just wants to bark and play. He hears his sister's collar, and he just feels that it's time to play at 2 a.m, and it's not. And once he hears her collar, he just feels that it's time to get up and play, and he will not be quiet. He just barks and barks and barks, and he knows it's bedtime, and at 2 a.m, we are not happy.
Yeah.
And I just don't know what to do. So, you know, I'm not big, like I said, I'm not big on barking collars, and, you know, I'll tell him to be quiet, and it usually lasts for a few minutes, seconds.
So he hears the other dog's collar?
Well, he hears her, you know, her
tags
little,
jingling?
Tags.
And
tags.
Is she walking around in the middle of the night at 2 a.m?
Well, she probably went and got a drink of water or something and then went back to bed.
Oh, okay. Well, number one, I can't imagine why you would be distressed about barking at 2 a.m. I'd be perfect. Yeah. Poor baby.
Oh,
you have my sympathy, poor baby. I'm not at my best at 2 a.m. A couple of things, and some of them are just really logistical, you know? It's like, what, you got a PhD and you're telling me to have the dogs separated more, you know? It's like, I mean, literally, sometimes it's like, okay, what's the behavioral problem? What's the trigger? And how can we change the environment to get rid of the trigger? So if the trigger really is the jingling tags of your older dog walking up, you know, getting up and getting a drink, take the collar off at night. I mean, literally, you know, try, experiment. Maybe it's, could we be so lucky that it's that simple? Sometimes it is. So think about that. You know, what are the triggers and how can I change that? So if it's the dog getting up, maybe not the tags jingling, but he just hears the other dog getting up and that wakes your youngster up, have where they sleep more separated, you know, just make it quieter. So that's one, but it sounds like the dog barks often in other contexts too. It's not just 2 a.m. So, you know, some dogs are just a lot more vocal than others. I share your lack of love of dogs who bark continuously.
Oh.
I find it tiring myself. I really do. So a couple of things. One, you keep in mind that you have a one-year-old Heeler. So you have an adolescent who was bred to move 1,000-pound animals around by barking and nipping, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a Blue Heeler. That's what they do. And so you have a dog that's old enough and mature enough to get in all kinds of trouble, but not emotionally mature enough to basically calm itself down when it wants to. So some of this is just going to go away because you have a dog. It's sort of the most difficult behavioral time in a dog's life. So that's part of it. You also have a super active dog. So I don't know how much exercise, mental and physical, this healer gets. But I would go out of my way to teach this dog a lot of tricks, which can mentally tire dogs out. I can't tell you how many times I've seen a dog sleep three times as long after a trick training session than after a big fetching session where they run and they run and they run and they run and they run. You know how we can get mentally tired? You know,
yeah,
you
sit absolutely.
Right, you sit at a desk all day and you're exhausted. It's like, why am I exhausted?
Or after lecturing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, meeting with students, grading papers, which I found absolutely exhausting. So dogs are the same way. You can mentally tire them and then they just want a break. And often the way they do that is go to sleep. Lots of chew toys. A year old is really, really mouthy, chewy. I need my mouth to be doing things age. So that's the other thing I would try. So those are a few tips. Hopefully that will help you and get you through a little more maturity.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling.
Or she could get cows.
Yeah, that's the other solution, Cindy. Thank you. Joanne in Viroqua, hello.
Hi. Hello. Yes, I have two kitties. They're both very affectionate, but have been indoor kitties, and I would like to transition them to indoor-outdoor kitties because I spend a tremendous amount of time in the yard gardening and because I don't feel like I'm able to give them anywhere near enough stimulation in the house.
Okay.
They're up to date on their shots, and I've gotten both of them ID tags that have my name and address on them as well as their name.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm so glad you asked because there's all kinds of things I'd love to say about that. One is I love that you're thinking about getting your cats more stimulation because I know there are a lot of cats who are very happy indoors. And that might actually include yours. Sometimes cats who have been indoors all their lives, you give them an opportunity outdoors. They're like, it's a nightmare out there. I know Larry had a cat, was like, don't ever, ever, ever make me do that again. That was a nightmare out there. So cats do need a lot of stimulation, but exactly sort of where and what kind is, one, partly up to the cat, but it's also, there are a lot of other considerations. One is safety. I mean, we all know that it's more dangerous outside for a cat than it is inside. One of the tricky things about cats, especially indoor cats, is when they are afraid, if they're outside and something scares them, they go in hiding. And unlike a dog who will sometimes bark if it's sort of lost or stuck or trapped, cats' instinct is, if they're in danger, is to be absolutely silent. So you can be 1 foot away from your cat who's like under a wood pile or something. And they're starving, right? They're terrified. They're exhausted. They're starving. And you're right there. They won't make a sound. So it can be dangerous out there. Also, it's dangerous for wildlife. You know, this is a big issue. We could talk about it for a long time, but I won't. But just to say that the research is very clear that domestic cats or house cats and have a profound negative effects on wildlife. But so here are the solutions that are working really well for some people. One is like we build a yard for our dogs, right? I mean, I would never let my little Cavalier just loose in the yard and garden because I'd look up and she'd be in the road. I mean, I would just never do that. So people build enclosures for their cats, and it's a little harder to build an enclosure, but like a sort of a screen cat enclosure that you can create outdoors where they're outdoors and they're close to where you're gardening, but they're enclosed, they're safe, and wildlife is safe on the outside. You can Google it, just look online to see what you can find. The other potential solution is some people train their cats to accept a harness and a long line. And so it takes a little time. Put a harness on a cat the first time and they're like not going to be thrilled. You have to go through it slowly and use a lot of reinforcement and treats and get them used to the feeling. But there are people who walk their cats on a harness on leash and their cats seem to love it. People who take their cats on their bicycles with them. So that's another perspective. Those are the two, I think, best ideas that I have for you.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And let's go to Kathy in Viroqua. Hi, Kathy. Kathy, are you there?
Happy March. Hello.
Hi there. What's on your mind?
Okay, our dog died back in March, and we have decided we would like to get another puppy after we got through our mourning process a bit. It was really, really hard to lose her. She was a great dog. But I'm wondering if Patricia could suggest one of her books or a couple of her books that would be good for us getting a three-month-old puppy and help us raise a happy family companion.
Oh, I love that you're asking. And you know, how long do we have here, right?
So, we've got about, for now, we've got about 45 seconds, and we can come back to it after
okay.
our news.
Okay, so you asked about a book. My book that I would suggest is The Puppy Primer. You can find that on my website. Just go to myname.com. But the first thing I want to talk about after the break is one of the most important things is who that puppy is, where that puppy came from, and how it's been raised for 12 weeks before you get it.
That is very good advice. If you haven't picked the puppy out yet, there are ways. You have some good tricks. Not tricks. Just good
ideas.
Ways to observations. Ways to do that. So, Kathy, you stay listening. And everybody else, you stay listening as well as we visit with Patricia McConnell, Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist, talking some about emotions in our dogs and our cats, but other animal behavior questions as well. A number to call, by the way, 1-800-642-1234. And we will be back with Patricia right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Patricia McConnell, Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist, international speaker, and author of a number of books. Great to have her along to talk about animal behavior. We've zeroed in a bit on emotions. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say at 800-642-1234 or by emailing us at ideas@wpr.org. And Patricia, before our news break, Kathy in Viroqua had called. She had lost her dog, unfortunately, to cancer in March. They're getting a three-month-old puppy. How can she raise him to be a good family dog? And you had some good advice.
And a question, Kathy, I think you're still there. Have you had the dog picked out yet?
We do have the dog picked out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's exciting. Yeah. What is she?
She's a mixed breed. She's half golden retriever and half labradoodle. So she looks more like a Labrador, but who knows what will happen when she matures.
I'm trying to figure out how to put those three words together, because there's a labradoodle and a golden doodle, and now she's a labradoodle doodle.
It's just a plain golden retriever. No doodle.
Right. But that's
a labradoodle. So
right.
Labrador and...
Oh. Gotcha. Well, that's so exciting. So that's wonderful that you have her all picked out. That's really fun. I think some of the most important things to think about when you get this little young, plastic, flexible brain that is still growing and changing and learning is to, one, help it learn your rules. You know, I basically think people should be raising puppies, not training them as much as anything. Of course, it involves a lot of teaching and training. But so before, one of the most important things to do is before the puppy comes, make some decisions. What are the house rules? And be as consistent as you can possibly be, which for two people who live together is almost impossible, but you can do your best, right? Do your best to decide. We don't want we want the puppy to sleep in this room. We don't want her to sleep in the bedroom. We do want her to sleep in the bedroom in a crate. We want her to sleep on the bed. We want her to not jump up on the couch, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one. Decide what your house rules are going to be before she comes. And then most importantly, and this is sort of almost anti-intuitive, at least it's anti the way we humans tend to behave and think, is rather than reacting to something she does wrong, I want you to think constantly about what you want her to do as a grown-up adult dog and reinforce that. So for an example, a lot of people don't like their dog to jump up on visitors when visitors come. So one of the things you can do is just simply every time there's a person anywhere, you know, comes to visit, right, mm-hmm. is you reinforce the dog every time all four paws are on the floor. So maybe the puppy's on a leash and there's somebody who's standing a few feet away. Every time that puppy's paws are all four on the floor, it gets a treat. You just throw it down on the floor. And it basically learns that every time a stranger is approaching me or coming into the house, I keep my paws on the ground, and I'm really happy to do that. And they don't even have to consciously make that association. You're just training a behavior. So the idea of focusing on what you do want rather than reacting to what you don't want, once you get it, it's so fun and it's so easy, but it still takes a lot of mental energy, I found, right. because it's not the way we human primate chimpanzees react. So that's really important. The other is absolutely learn as much as you can about using positive reinforcement effectively. And it's not bribing dogs. It's not giving dogs cookies for being rude. It's understanding that the science behind behavior is absolutely, completely clear from every study, every perspective you can possibly come up with. Positive reinforcement is the most fun and effective way to influence behavior and keep a good, healthy, strong, loving relationship between you and your dog. So learn how to use it well, and you'll be happy forever after.
And you have a nice book on training it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you. The Puppy Primer is a great dog for as a great dog is a great book that will get you started. There's another book, Family Dog Training, that talks about sort of the next steps. You know, because you don't want to spend a lot of time teaching a little puppy to stay. They can't concentrate for that long. But you can get them started as a little baby puppy for like a 5-second stay. So, yeah. And then the other end of the leash is the book I wrote about. Understanding dog behavior from their perspective and our perspective as that sort of complicated naked primate that we are.
Kathy, thank you. I want to turn to Jan in Oak Creek next. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I thank you for this program, both of you. I've known about Patricia for many years. I just wanted to, like, vote in about the animals having emotions. Oh, my gosh. About 8 years ago, I had a Saint Bernard that died, and the other dog that I had at the time, they were together, but not for a long period of time. She was about 2.5. I was devastated. We came home from the vet together because I actually took her along with me so that she could, you know, smell her when she was
good for you.
And that was the first time I had ever done that after having Saints for many years. But anyway, so she knew what happened to her. Came home. She ran around the house like, oh, this is, you know, and I'm like, what is going on with her? I'm devastated. And I contacted our animal communicator. And I don't know what you guys think about animal communicators, but I have the highest respect for them also. She said that the saint that was left, the younger one, she wasn't sad at all. She was glad that Abby was gone, the other one, because now she could, you know, she could be the head of the household and be the center of attention and everything. And it's like, oh, my gosh.
There you go.
I'm so glad you mentioned that because it was similar to my experience, and it's often not expected. And I love that Larry remembered that story from my book because it's, you know, we make a lot of assumptions about what's going on inside those furry little heads, and we're not always right. Well, thank you for telling us that story.
And it sort of reminds me again about the Animal Behavior Society free public day that's coming up.
Yeah, thank you so much. The Animal Behavior Society is the annual convention of scientists who study animal behavior. But this is for the public. It's free. It's in the UW-Milwaukee campus on August 4th. I think it starts at 2 to 6. And there's going to be a talk on how the new hot, there's so much really cool hot research on genetics and brain function related to behavior that we can apply to our relationship with our pets. So this is very much an applied day about learning about the hot, new, cool research on behavior from, again, physiology, brain function, cognition, genetics, and how it applies to our everyday life. So can we talk about new research and dog behavior? Great talk. I can't wait to hear it about the new research and horse behavior and how to have... You know, horses, a lot of horse behavior is based on fear. They're prey animals. They may be huge, but they're prey animals. And so Dr. Foster is going to, and Dr. Donaldson, Tammy Donaldson, is going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about reading your dogs. I'm going to talk about how much can you tell about how your dog is feeling by their posture, their facial expression, their vocalizations, and lots of really fun research and videos, and we're going to have a great time. So I hope you can come. Go to the Animal Behavior Society website or my website. Again, it's free. There are CEUs available for dog trainers who's always looking for continuing education credits. And so come up. If you heard it on Larry's show, you just please come up and say hi to me.
And that's, again, the date on that is?
It's August 4th. It's Saturday afternoon, August 4th, UW-Milwaukee campus, Animal Behavior Society Public Day.
I remember another story that you told me a long time back about a horse. When you were talking about horses, I kind of flashed on it. A horse that had gotten away and was running along the road, and you used, and people were trying to get it, and you had that horse come to you just based on, I thought it was posture.
Yeah, it was a pony, actually.
Pony.
And it was a pony running down a freeway. It was a freeway, Larry. It was terrifying. It was a freeway, and people were chasing it, understandably. But, you know, what do horses do when you chase them? They're prey animals. They run away. I was very lucky in that I was able to... You know, that is not always a fixable solution. You know,
that
was very, very lucky in that... I don't remember exactly. I think somebody had a pail, and I was able to, the horse stopped, and I stopped my car, and I got out, and there were a couple of people, and I said, please, everybody stop running. And the horse had stopped, or the pony was, you know, panting and snorting. And I was able to make some noises. I think I shook, I'm not positive, but I think I was like shaking a bucket, like there's grain in a bucket. There wasn't, but I put some rocks in there. And then I said, okay, everybody, let's turn around. And go the other way. And basically, we ended up getting this little pony to stop running away, you know, and come to us. So I don't, honestly, that was so long ago, I don't remember all the details. It's a little fuzzy in my brain. Speaking of emotions and brains and animals,
but
mine's getting a little old. But yeah, it was based on.
But here's an example of what you might be able to apply if you go to the Animal Behavior Society event. You could learn some things that could help in that situation or all kinds of situations.
Yes, and one of the things, great point, Larry, and one of the things I want to add is that one of the things that happened to me, I was so lucky, is when I studied, when I got my degree in zoology, and a minor in psychology, because I focused on ethology, or the science of behavior in a natural environment, I learned about the behavior of hundreds and hundreds of different species. And that gave me a really different and good and important perspective when working with dogs and people. And so even if you're not interested in the, you know, say you're a dog lover, come to the whole thing. Listen to Dr. Foster and Dr. Donaldson talk about horse behavior, because it will teach you something about you, and it will teach you something about your dog, because the more perspective we can, the sort of wider we open up our perspective, the more we can narrow down, ironically, into applying it to everyday interactions with our companion animals.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, we have more callers. Vicki in Mount Horeb is up next. Vicki, thanks for waiting. What can we do for you?
Hello. We have two grand dogs that are
just absolutely wonderful dogs in all ways, but they're often here together with our son and his wife is the one, and our daughter has the other dog. One of the dogs is quite dominant, and the other one is a very submissive dog. And they, in the house, they're fine. They don't get on each other. But if they are allowed to go play out in the yard, which they both seem to love, mm-hmm. it very quickly deteriorates. And the dominant one will take down the more submissive one. They're fairly, the submissive one weighs about 45, 46 pounds. The dominant one is probably about 60, so a little bigger. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it's like the playing, I don't know if you...
Gets
if
out of hand.
Bully or, yeah, it does. And it, you know, it kind of scares all of us. They separate easily because they both come so well when called. But we often dog sit, too. And we do not dog sit at the same time because I worry a little bit about the dominant one.
I would love, I wish I could see a videotape. I wish I could, because there are a couple things that could be going on. And one of the ways you can find out, there are some ways you can find out. So the two things that could be going on is, one, this is just the way they play, you know, and one dog does want to be on top and the other dog's perfectly fine. So the way you find out if that's true is after you separate them, you're going to see if the more, quote, submissive dog goes right back to play with the other one. So you're just asking the dog, do you want to keep this up or not? And if the dog is like, yeah, I'm good, you know, then it's probably okay. However, it is absolutely true that there are dogs who during play get into a kind of a spiral of arousal.
Mm.
And they get more and more aroused. And that's when you can get into trouble and get into a fight. So if you see there's a dog on the bottom, is on the bottom, the one on the top is growling louder, deeper, lower, or higher. You know, the growl, they can sort of go either way. The growls are changing substantially from what they were before. And you're looking at this dog and thinking, is this really okay? Then you're very good to intervene. But if you call them to come right away, and they instantly come right away, I'm less concerned about the arousal level of the dog on top. So that I would experiment a little bit. And if you have a local dog trainer or behaviorist, it would be great to take a videotape and show it to an experienced trainer, because some play sounds really aggressive. I actually have to warn farm sitters that when Willie and Maggie play, they'll play tug. They play tug games, and their growling sounds excessive, and their arousal. There was a point I was like, is this okay? I don't know if this is okay or not. And I would stop them, but then a couple of times I was like, yeah, well, let's see. They were fine. They completely self-regulated. So I would do some research to try and experiment and see, is this really a problem or not? The fact that you can call them away and they come instantly, that's a really good sign.
Yeah, that's a really good sign.
We need more data. Need more data.
I was thinking about my own cats who love to play, and they will, one will get on top of the other one. And the larger of the two will always switch roles, and he can be he doesn't have to be the dominant one all the time. He'll lay on his back and let the other one kind of chew around him.
And that's a sign of really healthy play, of role reversal, right?
Yeah.
So it sounds like these dogs aren't ever doing that. And so, I see your concern, and, so it could be a problem and it could not. More data.
There you go, Vicki. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Catherine in Madison. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. We have 8 retired sled dogs, and they're indoor-outdoor dogs, and some of them have been marking in the house, and I'd like to know how to make them stop doing that. We don't know who it is.
And they used to live outside?
Well, no, they're all indoor. They've always been kind of indoor-outdoor.
Okay. Are some intact males?
Yes.
I bet on the intact ones.
So it is real. Now, it's not just males, and it's not just males who have not been neutered, but that is the highest probability. I always want to start with the highest probability statement, right? So it is most likely the guys. So very often in that case, neutering them, if you are amenable to that, is a very important first step. Is it magically going to make it go away now that they have the habit of going in the house? Not necessarily, but it's going to decrease their predisposition to do it. So that's something to think about. The other advice is more complicated. It's not complicated. It's just more work for you. Is whenever people have a house training problem, the dog is going in the house, I basically say, one of the things we have to do is go back to treating them like a puppy, like a seven-week-old puppy who just, you know, hopefully is an older puppy now. We know better that puppies should come later. So it's a 10-week-old puppy that comes into your house. You never let it alone for a second because you don't want them to get in the habit of going in the house. So ideally, you would neuter the males. You would treat all the areas such that you've done everything you can to eliminate the smell of urine to a dog, not to you, but to a dog. Because remember, that's how they decide where to go. We do it visually, right? Think about it. We look for the sign, restroom. We look for the white bowl. You know, we use our eyes to go. Dogs use their nose. And so if there's a smell of urine, it's like, yep, this is the place. This is where I should go. So you have to get rid of that. And the other is to treat them like puppies. You never let them alone. If one of them lifts his leg, or it could be a female, if, you know, one of the females squats and pees, you are right there to distract her. You know, I'm not averse in any way to saying like, nope, clapping your hands and then running the dog outside. I would go back and give them treats for going to the bathroom outside. So they're like, wow, if I pee outside, I get chicken. This is good. I trained my owner to give me chicken. If I pee, I can do that. So those are the three things I do. That's the best chance of getting things turned around.
That makes good sense to me. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, I want to go back once more to the event on August 4th, the Animal Behavior Society event. It is a free event, as you were saying, but would you still want people, is there a registration anyway?
You can just show up. Just come get a good seat. You don't have to register. You can go to the Animal Behavior site or my site to get information about exactly where it is. It's on the UW-Milwaukee campus. And just come up and say hi.
And your site again is?
PatriciaMcConnell.com.
You have a lot of good information on that site.
Thank you. There's a learning center that has a ton of, again, free information about many issues, including emotions and dogs and behavior problems.
Yeah, and how to deal with them. So, Patricia, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
You know it's fun for me. Thanks for having me, Larry.
You'll be back. We'll do this again, I hope.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, I will.
All right. Patricia McConnell, our guest today. She's a certified applied animal behaviorist, an international speaker and author. We talked about several of her books today, and you'll find, you can get them pretty much anywhere, but you will find more about them on her website, PatriciaMcConnell.com, for sure. And don't forget about that August 4th event at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, the Animal Behavior Society event. Going to be great fun indeed. Well, tomorrow we'll talk with entomologist P.J. Leash. We'll talk about army worms. They've been creating some issues. White-lined sphinx moth caterpillars and some other interesting insects as well. And he'll take your questions, of course. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.